If you're a conscientious sort of parent, you probably worry about how little your child seems to read books for pleasure. We'll discover what you can do about that as we review John and Kay Linscoog's book, How to Grow a Young Reader.
Is one style of fathering more effective than another, and have you got it? For years, career counselor Ralph Matson has been helping big corporations harness the individual uniquenesses of their people. In a moment, he'll show you how these same factors influence your success at home as a dad.
Welcome again to Short Shots for Dads. This is Tape 4. I'm Paul Lewis, editor of Dad's Only Newsletter, and your host, along with Carl Miller, for the next few minutes, as we share ideas and tips that can help you be a more effective father and husband. On this side of the tape are five short segments designed for listening while you're driving or shaving. Side two is the best 30 minutes of a roundtable discussion between three fathers, and you're invited to join in.
Right now, let's return to Paul's conversation with Mr. Paul DeCourt about the impact of today's music upon our kids. In part one on tape three, Paul discussed contemporary beats, lyrics, how peer pressure draws kids in, and the response parents can make.
Now, another area that I think is very important for a parent, both in music and in the rest of their children's life, is to set goals and to sit down and write down goals with their kids and help them to become goal-orientated. And a lot of kids today have no goals. They just wander aimlessly. So if their goal then is to live a pure, wholesome life, then you can relate the things they do to their goal and the music they listen to their goal. And if they have set the goals, and you can remind them, remember this goal that we set, and you can read it to them or say it to them, and then say, now does this party or does this music or does this or this or this, how does that relate to this goal? And then they will make the decision, ah, well, maybe you're right. I guess it doesn't relate to the goal. And so I use that a lot with music with our own kids. I think another area that we must use is the scripture. The scripture is full, especially in Proverbs, of wise and foolish, good and bad. For instance, a man shall not be established by wickedness. Now you look at music today and you see who's producing it and where the money is being spent, and that the mafia runs a lot of the record companies and that Satan is in charge. You look at the lyrics and you have to say it's wickedness. And then you relate back to this scripture. Or you could say a wise man feeds on truth, but the mocker feeds on trash. Is today's music truth? Or is it trash? And I think if we appeal to the intellect of the young person, then they will figure that out for themselves.
These are terrific ideas, Paul. What else have you got that could give a parent more help?
Well, to me, music is, I mean, my life is wrapped up in music. It's my job. I had a church choir for 15 years, so both sacred and secular. And of course, I deal in children's music. Children love music. And unfortunately, today, kids are not being exposed to a wide variety of music. There's some wonderful, happy, classical music. And if a young child, not knowing any better, is given some classical records to listen to for bedtime, they will learn to appreciate and enjoy that music. That would be the same of folk music or pop music, whatever it might be. So there again, I think a variety is good.
Well, I think you've been very helpful here in giving us a feel for what to go for. If you had to boil it down to some guidelines for assessing music and all of its various forms in our culture, what would they be?
Starting very young is very important. Explaining to the child that it is a battle, as I mentioned, back and forth. God has placed the children under the protectance and guidance of their parents, and the parents want to help the children. And then recognizing that the mind is a computer and telling them that whatever they put in it is what they will become. Setting standards by the parents listening. A lot of parents listen to, for instance, country music. Country music has some very bad, questionable lyrics in it also. So being a good parental example is very important. Letting the child know that it is coming, that they are going to have to face the peer pressure and be forced into situations will mentally let them know that they then have their parents as a resource to help them with that. There's one other area that I think is important, and that's that young people listening to pop music today will hear key phrases that they don't understand, and they're double-meaning words. And I think that a parent needs to explain to them what something like the phrase cheap trick means. There are phrases that I think if the kids knew what they meant, they would be a little bit shocked, you know, and say, wow, I didn't know that, Mom or Dad, you know, I won't listen to that anymore. So I think that parents actually sitting down and listening to a young person's records with them, whether they like the music or not, and then explaining what some of those things mean, the child then will make the decision, hey, that is bad for me.
Well, it seems like we end up as parents just always saying no, coming across negative so much about today's music because it is so negative. How can we better respond to our children?
Well, I think that parents need to be aware that there is a creative alternative to this situation. And as we've already mentioned, the sacred music field has duplicated to a great extent the sound of popular records, but they have put acceptable lyrics with them. And if you can find out what kind of music your kid likes, and if it's a pop girl singer, then swing her over and buy her a couple of Evie records or Honey Tree or some of the current things that are very nice sounding but have very acceptable lyrics, because the same thing will happen. They'll listen to it over and over, and they will come to like the music very much because it's so near to what they're listening to. Secondly, is that there are many concerts, at least in our area here, available for them to go to. And they enjoy doing that because they can do it with their friends. And they hear the same kind of music, and they have fun, and it's a party atmosphere, but they're listening to very acceptable music.
Paul, you've really given us a lot of food for thought and how to work with our kids. Thanks so much for taking these minutes with us.
Thank you, Paul DeCourt. We'll be back in a moment with tips on keeping grandparents and grandchildren in touch. Who can help parents understand kids better than someone who's raised a few to adulthood? And who can help kids understand their parents better than someone who's known those parents since they were in diapers? Well, no wonder grandparents can add such a mature and mellow perspective to family life.
Unfortunately, Carl, these days this rich resource goes largely untapped. But it wasn't always that way. Until recent times, grandparents were active members of the extended family unit, spending valuable time working, teaching, and playing with the younger members. But today, it's rare to find a family living in the same neighborhood, or even city, with both sets of grandparents. So most grandparents have only a precious few days of visits with their grandchildren each year.
As fathers, Paul, we need to make it a priority to encourage our parents' active involvement in the lives of our children. So let's list a few ideas to help, starting with the problem of long-distance grandparents. First of all, take some time to think of ways you can keep grandparents up to date on what's happening in your family. Sending them occasional tape cassettes can be a great help, with each child reporting on the tape the important events and people in his or her life just now. This gives grandparents a window into the kids' thoughts and feelings at this stage in their growth, and it forms a basis for genuine communication and sharing. In addition, whenever you write or phone your parents, be sure to fill them in on the recent significant concerns of your children.
The phone is a versatile tool for building long-distance relationships, Carl. Here are just a couple of creative ideas for grandparents to make the most of it. With older kids, have grandparents arrange to watch a TV sports event together with your kids by telephone. The first short call could be just long enough to make predictions and cheer the kickoff or whatever action begins the game. If they're rooting for opposite teams, when a score is made, it's fun for the triumphant fan to call and rub it in. Then a call during the last few minutes of the game can be especially exciting. The total cost of such a get-together should be no more than a half hour of long-distance time, less than the price of a ticket to the game.
And with younger kids, a short bedtime story by phone could be the highlight of a whole week. arrange it ahead of time so the child can anticipate the event and move a phone into the child's room so he or she can listen right in bed.
Carl, how about using the mail? Most children get hardly any mail at all, so letters and cards from grandparents are always welcome. Correspondence can be livened up with interesting trivia items, kids love to quote them, or jokes and riddles. Or think of unusual inserts like a souvenir program or a photo from a favorite team or music group. Grandparents can write the organization or agent involved for information. And the next time they're in a restaurant, have them check for paper placemats with games, quizzes, or mazes on them. They can also clip out crossword puzzles, riddles, poems, news items, or magazine articles of interest to your child, and send them with a note that says, "When I read this, I thought of you." It's a great way to encourage kids to read and creates a source of common knowledge and interests between grandparents and kids. And remember, these ideas are fun even if you live next door.
You know, Paul, it seems to me that one of the most important things children can receive from their grandparents is a sense of roots, vital facts, anecdotes, and insights into family history. The older folks are living links between children and the past, so they should be on the lookout for opportunities to tell about ancestors or even personal stories from their own childhood. They could even construct a family tree or write a family history as a joint long-term project with the kids. Or a few evenings of reminiscing with a tape recorder would make a priceless oral history to be passed down. And don't forget the old photos, postcards, and heirlooms. They make great visual aids in family storytelling.
And another vital role for grandparents, Carl, is to act as a sounding board for kids. Children often need adults other than their parents to talk to, and who's a more trusted candidate for the job than a grandmother or father? Especially when a child needs to discuss a problem that concerns parents. So you need to give your parents and in-laws permission to counsel with your children, and then provide times for the kids to be alone with the grandparents so they'll have an opportunity to talk.
And that brings us to the subject of visits, Paul. Whether the children are going to grandma's house or grandma's coming to your house for a few days, the key to having the most enjoyment is to plan for it. Let the kids and grands conspire by phone, listing possible activities and making a tentative calendar, in pencil, of course, in case plans change. No need to fill up every day, but at least a few firm plans will enable you or the grandparents to arrange for tickets and transportation and to rearrange the normal family routine. Now, another possibility is for the kids and the grands to take a trip together. It doesn't have to be far. A short jaunt to the beach or a bus ride to the next town can offer plenty of excitement.
When grandparents are alone with children, Carl, it's a perfect opportunity for them to share their knowledge and skills. Older people have so much to teach, whether it's how to bake bread, cast for trout, play chess, or play the stock market. Often grandparents can pass on skills that parents never learned or don't have time to teach. And a new skill can be one of the best, most natural gifts a grandparent has to give.
Speaking of gifts, Paul, we should mention just briefly how parents can help grandparents choose gifts for children wisely. It's easy for someone who hasn't had children at home for a while to lose track of which gifts are likely to be popular or to be overwhelmed by choices available in toys, books, and clothes. Parents can help as Christmas or birthdays approach by discussing with the grandparents what would be appropriate to the child's interests, age level, and tastes. For comprehensive gift-giving guidelines, take a look in the appendix of Dr. Fitzhugh Dodson's popular paperback, How to Father. You can find it in any local bookstore, and it's loaded with many unusual and very practical ideas.
Up next, a conversation with popular educator Dr. Howard Hendricks on how to put the magic of family camping experiences to work in your family relationships. I'm talking with Dr. Howard Hendricks at Dallas Theological Seminary in the Department of Christian Education. I don't suppose there's a kid alive who ever went camping with his folks that doesn't reflect on those memories as fabulous times. What is it, in your view, that is so dynamic about families that camp?
I think, Paul, they intensify interpersonal relationships. If you were to ask my kids, what are your greatest memories, every one of them will revolve around our camping experiences. Because that's the time we had Dad full time. No telephone, no involvement at the office, and that's their treasure chest of memories, which I think is one of the primary things that a parent gives to a child. I've asked them oftentimes, you know, what do you remember most about it? Well, they remember us driving in a Jeep over the high country. We used to save every year. We couldn't afford to do a lot of things, and in those days they would rent a Jeep for $20 a day, going down these roads, you know, weaving, and I'd be singing the silly songs I learned when I was in Scouts or some other organization when I was a kid, and they thought they were absolutely out of sight. I was more like myself then than at any other time.
You found more of who you enjoyed being?
Mm-hmm.
Pulled out of you by that environment?
Oh, it would potentiate me. I would absolutely get out of my gourd with enthusiasm. I mean, I'd come up with creative ideas, and I wasn't involved in anything, so I had kubu amounts of time to give to them.
Does a dad have to go through a mental preparation for a time like that?
It would often take me anywhere from a half a week to a week to unwind. This is why I think that generally vacations that are split up in little weak units are worthless, at least for an executive or for somebody who is deeply involved. It takes you almost a week to unwind, then you start getting normal, you know, without all of the twitches and the rest of the stuff that you develop in a pressurized society. That's when I began to enjoy life again.
Many times I've said it's the little moments that kids remember a lot, as opposed to the grandiose trips and so forth. Do you think that the big trip brings something back into the family dynamics that comes home with them?
Yeah, I really think so, Paul. I think that there is a renewing quality to an experience like this, both in expectation and in reflection, as well as in participation. See, it's all exciting, all three levels. Because we used to spend all year planning the trip, and the kids would write away to the Chamber of Commerce where we were going and get all kinds of historical data. They'd do research. We'd get projects. We'd have to set up the tent. We got a new tent, so we had to figure out how to do it, and the whole thing would collapse on us, and we'd get in the middle and roar, you know, and have more fun just as getting ready for the thing. Then, of course, the participation is always an exciting experience. But think of the memories again, because we take slides. We did some tape recording of things that we wanted to remember.
What are the key ingredients, then, to a successful family vacation in terms of camping? Can you do it in a motel? Or is it best with the more primitive elements of a tent and a Coleman stove or whatever?
Well, I think, from my point of view, ideally, the more primitive, the better, because it's a unique experience. But I don't think it has to be that kind. You know, my wife is not particularly the primitive camper type. I kid her. She's the Holiday Inn camper. But I personally believe that one of the problems in our type of culture is that this kind of experience is so unique that when people get into it, they find it a brand new lifestyle. It's something they've never experienced before in their life. And it's so different from what they normally experience that is true recreation. Because recreation is much a change of pace and a change of place as it is just, you know, going off and doing something.
Hitting the whole family in the act is one of the dynamics that happens.
That to us was the key to it. You asked for some of the characteristics, and one of them was good preparation, really doing your homework before you go. And what we used to do in the earlier days before we get started is just go out here to a park someplace and take some of the kids out overnight. Or take them out and teach them how to cook a meal. And so we took the baked potatoes, and we took a piece of meat and some other things and biscuits, and we'd make them, and it'd be pretty sad. But the point is, they were learning how. But after they got the skills, you know, then they could cook very, very delicious meals. The interesting thing, and it blows most people's mind, all of my children know how to cook, fellas as well as gals. And most of it came out of that camping type of experience. But the second thing is the one you've alluded to, and that is it's a shared experience. Everybody had responsibility. Everybody was in the act. You know, no passive individual, no spectators. The interesting thing is, and there are a lot of studies to this point, that the average vacation to an executive is usually a drag. It is not what he expected it to be. That is, it does not renew him. It does not recoup his strengths and energies. And the reason is exactly what you have stated, and that is he becomes passive. He is not actively involved, responsible. It's not a unique experience to him. It's just sort of a drag, and he gets bored with the whole thing. And you know, a lot of families just get knocked down, drag out arguments in the midst of a vacation.
So a critical thing is for the expectation on the part of dad to be well conceived.
Yeah, I think the father here is in so many areas is the key to it. We were in a situation one night, we got 8 inches of rain in the night. And I asked my son, Bill, hey, Bill, did you dig the trenches deep? My friend, if he had dug the thing 5 feet deep, we would have been exactly where we were. And that is a couple miles down a creek bed, you know, all our stuff washed out. But, you know, if we get together, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about getting washed out. I mean, that was the experience of our lifetime. You know, this fakey idea that it's always got to be neat and tidy and everything come out right and perfect, you know. But this isn't life, and it isn't what memories are made of.
Thanks, Howie.
A book review on how to cultivate a love for books in your home is the subject of our next segment. We'll be right back.
Did you know, Carl, that nearly 3,000 new children's books are published every year in the United States? Add to that the books which were published earlier and are still in print, and you have more than 40,000 available children's books in English. Even if just a quarter of them are worthwhile, that's 10,000 good books out there waiting for our children, with 700 more added each year.
Well, for the parent who's looking for good reading material for the kids, sorting through such a mountain of books is an overwhelming task. And that's precisely the reason, Paul, why John and Kay Linskoog have written How to Grow a Young Reader, A Parent's Guide to Kids and Books. John is a teacher, Kay is an author of 4 other books, and they have 2 sons who've been their laboratory in learning how to cultivate book lovers at home.
The authors survey the most important books for kids, from the first one published in 1671 to the present. And they review the best in fantasy, realistic fiction, biography, history, poetry, and picture books. Whatever your children's interests or reading level, they're sure to find excellent books to suit them in the lists the Linskoogs have compiled.
Of course, Paul, finding good books for them to read is only half the battle. Parents need to know as well how to interest their children in those books and how to cultivate that interest into a lifelong love of reading. The Linskoogs devote several chapters to handling that challenge, so let's talk about some of the details of their approach.
Well, Carl, the first step in directing children's interest toward reading is to reduce the competition. Television is confronted in the chapter called Reign of the One-Eyed Dragon. Even preschoolers average a total of 54 hours per week watching TV. And though children today have inherited a great wealth of good literature, they seem to be held spellbound by a cold, magic eye. So the battle has to begin by taming or eliminating such a powerful distraction from books. However you choose to do it, whether by simply limiting viewing hours or keeping the TV set in the attic or moving it out altogether, parents who are serious about encouraging reading must find an approach that works for their family. Try a simple experiment. Eliminate television from your home for one night a week, or for weekends, or even totally, for a period of time you agree to beforehand. 2 months would make a useful trial period. Anything less doesn't really give the experiment a fair chance to succeed. Next, go to the library as a family and load up on books, making sure everyone has some material to read. Then, during the time when you would normally be viewing TV, gather in the same room for reading, some quietly and some aloud together. Even if it's only for one night a week during those 2 months, if you stick to the experiment, you'll likely enjoy it so much that you'll add another night before too long. And once the kids have gone cold turkey and gotten the taste of reading pleasure, you'll have fewer objections from them to unplugging the set.
So far, we've focused on the negative aspects of the strategy, reducing the competition. So let's take a look now at some positive ways to help. Ideally, children should be exposed to books from infancy. As soon as a child can sit up in your lap, you should begin showing them picture books with simple texts that you can read aloud. As in so many other areas, teaching a love for books is best accomplished by example. If kids see both parents reading frequently instead of watching TV, the impression will be more powerful than any lecture. Hearing parents talk about books is also important. And taking kids along to the library for a Saturday afternoon of browsing together and choosing treasures to bring home is time well spent in developing good reading habits.
Of course, Carl, the best way to interest children in good books is to have good books in the home. Though the cost of printed matter has risen sharply in the last decade, books are still one of the finest investments you can make for the sake of your child's mind. It's been said that the United States won't ever be a very literate nation until we spend as much for books as we do for chewing gum, and the point is well taken. In any case, whether they're purchased or borrowed from the library, books should be visible in the home, not just on the shelves, but left around in busy places where they'll tempt family members to stop and read. Some parents even set out books on tables around the house and change them from week to week, like vases of flowers or dishes of candy.
Another important point to remember, Paul, is that children need appropriate places to read. If your house is especially busy, set aside a quiet, out-of-the-way corner with a comfortable chair and good lighting. Daylight is best for reading, and keep in mind that some children become restless after eating sweets.
Besides quiet, private reading, Carl, families can establish a habit of reading aloud together, or one-on-one between parent and child. It's important to maintain a relaxed pace and pleasant tone of voice. Let the child participate as well. Ask questions and allow him or her to join in on refrains. Some children listen best when settled in bed. Others are best calmed by soaking in a bathtub. To prevent distractions, unplug the phone and turn off competing sound like from the stereo.
Some parents ask, at what age should a child no longer be read to? The answer is that you're never too old. Even after children can read well on their own, they enjoy hearing stories beyond their reading level. It stretches them.
And you know, Carl, older kids enjoy reading aloud to younger ones and to parents. A cassette tape of favorite readings would make a great gift for grandparents, or an item for the family archives. Some children may even want to write their own poems and stories to read aloud to the family.
Yes, Paul, a resourceful dad can find lots of ways to give children a love for language and a thirst for reading. If you're interested in learning more about how to grow a young reader, you can order the paperback from Dads Only for $3.95 plus $1.25 for postage and packaging. California residents add 6% sales tax. Just send your request with a check or charge card number and expiration date to Dads Only, Post Office Box 340, Julian, California, 92036. And as you explore the world of books with your family, remember the words of the children's poet Walter de la Mare: only the rarest kind of best in anything can be good enough for the young.
Well, Carl, in the last segment on this side, I'll be talking with career counselor Ralph Mattson about how individual motivational patterns affect fathering styles. What you'll learn will explain a lot about why you and your kids get along and why sometimes you don't.
I'm talking today with Ralph Mattson. Ralph is the father of four children, ages 22, 21, 17, and 14. And he's the Director of Educational Services for People Management Incorporated. Ralph, what is a motivated pattern and why is it important?
A motivated pattern is an identification of what an individual has to offer the work world. We believe that a person has a particular style of operating, and that it's possible to identify what that style is. Some of the clashes that people have, very often I've seen as clashes of personalities, what they are very often, clashes of motivated intentions.
What are the key components of an individual's pattern?
Well, we find by experience, having evaluated thousands of people, that there is a recurring number, usually an average of about 5 to 8 motivated abilities. And these abilities differ from other abilities in that you can use them again repeatedly without getting bored doing them. We don't say that people only have those abilities, but these are special. And then there is usually 3 to 5 subject matter, things that people want to work with. Some people want to work with people. Some people want to work with systems, hardwares, numbers. And they consistently do this. Then there is circumstances. Some people are triggered by particular factors such as needs, problems. You may find yourself inactive until the problem comes by, and because you're a problem solver, suddenly come into action and make your contribution. Then there is the way you relate to others in a work situation. Some people are individualists, some people are team members, some people are coaches or enablers, directive managers, or team leaders. There are a variety of ways of operating. We keep discovering new ones. And when you put all this together, you get an overview of about 20 elements that would indicate how you would operate in any situation.
Could it be that a certain matrix of patterns fit better with the fathering task than others?
Yes. I think there are certain patterns which naturally move to the responsibilities of fathering. And what happens, of course, is the people who are motivated this way kind of become our models as to what a father is, and then we try to become that kind of super father. And if we don't have the abilities to do that, we kind of feel upset about it, failures as fathers. If we know what our abilities are, then we can learn how to take on our responsibilities as fathers in a way that makes sense. People who have in their pattern, they're interested in people. They have people as a subject matter. They like relationships. They may be team members, and they want to move their family together as a team. They like to influence. They're developmental. They like to cultivate. These people really enjoy their role as fathers. Then you have others, you see, who are highly individualistic. There's no people in their subject matter. They like perhaps systems, and maybe they're brilliant in their work doing systems, and they have to come home to where their son, who's motivated to have relationships, is trying to establish more warm relationships, more time with son, and discovers that, try as he might, he really doesn't like doing that.
What I hear you saying is that there is a right way to father, but it's different for every individual?
Well, the model for the father can be a pretty tough act to try to produce. And what we suggest is the fact that we come to an understanding of how we're put together and then look at what is needed in the family. For example, a father who doesn't have managerial skills, who's married to someone who does, shouldn't bother with trying to organize things that somebody else can do pretty well organizing. You might prepare yourself to be a good relational person to your son and discover that he's highly independent and individual and he doesn't need all that relational stuff that somebody else is laying on you as a model.
Seems like recognizing this would cause everyone to kind of breathe a big sigh of relief.
Well, it's very hard to keep being a failure. And I think of people who are motivated to learn by doing, who go through most of their school life trying to produce learning by listening and reading, and realize that it wasn't that they couldn't learn or that they weren't smart, it was the fact that they were being taught the wrong way. Well, the same thing, I think, as fathers. We are expected to be so much, and we can't be all that. If you examine your own children and just see how they do things, why is one of your children so neat and the other so uncaring about whether things are neat? It's not so much your training. It has to do much more with the way the person's put together.
We at Dads Only are talking about working with you to develop a specific analysis of motivated patterns applied to fathering. But until that's available, how can a person have their pattern analyzed?
If they wrote us at People Management Incorporated, 10 Station Street, Simsbury, Connecticut 06070, we would send them some material on that. One of the advantages, too, is the fact that they could use the same pattern to consider some of their own career directions. One of the fun things to do is have patterns developed on mom and dad, and then sit down and say, hey, let's take a look at how we operate with one another. You avoid one of the recurring problems that we see so often. Mom keeps trying to change dad, and dad keeps trying to change mom. And we say, it just doesn't work that way. You're not going to change anybody. They are going to be what they are. Now you can improve things. You can certainly incorporate disciplines. You can develop things that you have. But you can't become somebody you are not already designed to be.